Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. A man standing alongside a road with his thumb out used to be a common sight on America's roadways. From the Great Depression until the mid-1970s, hitchhiking was a method of travel for servicemen, students, and cross-country travelers. But by 1980, thumbing a ride had all but vanished. The hitchhikers had disappeared. A new book, Thumbs Up, chronicles the travels of two young men in the summer of 1974. Where they went, who they met, and what riding in cars with strangers taught them about humanity, America, and perhaps most importantly, themselves. Thumbs Up author Frank O'Brien Bernini joins us now. Frank, welcome to All Sides.
Hey, thank you very much, Anna. It's a real pleasure to be here with you today. It's an absolute thrill.
It's been 50 years since you set off on your cross-country hitchhiking adventure. What made you write this book?
It was 50 years. However, in that 50-year time frame between, you know, when we took the trip in 1974 till today, so many times through my life, I connected events of that summer with the way I think or how I feel or who I became. And as we got up to the 50th anniversary, it was like, if not now, when? What an opportunity to kind of document and challenge others to think about their history and the events that shaped them. So it was time to do it, and it was a blast.
Before we get into all of your adventures, including how you convinced your parents to let you go, I want to talk briefly about the year 1974. This is the summer President Nixon resigns from office. It's the Watergate scandal. There's the leaving of the Vietnam War is still fresh in everybody's mind. There's a lot that's going on this year.
Yeah, absolutely. And in addition to that, it was an awesome time for music. And so, you know, that was one of the opportunities that we had, four or five, six different times a day being in cars with people as we got rides and listening to the music of the day. So, the political and the social context of the day was exactly as you described, getting over, our leaving the Vietnam War. It was just a time of transition for the country. And it was a wonderful time to experience the way people thought about the world and get five or six different viewpoints on that a day as we got rides along the way.
Yeah, you talk about music, and this is also when tape decks are starting to become common. So you're not just stuck listening to the radio. You can customize your cross-country playlist.
Yes, the world of music has clearly changed in this 50 years from back then. There was FM radio. however, generally, cars had AM radios, and so you were listening to very much the music of the regions that you were traveling through. So you would get to know, all right, country music is really popular here. That's all that's on. Or you'd get the farm reports or something like that. So, it was definitely a different time. But it was a time when Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones and David Bowie and Pink Floyd, they were all kind of early in their careers. And it was a quite exciting time for music.
Speaking of excitement, Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon album is a favorite of two young women who give you a ride. And you describe them with such, I don't know, I almost want to say irrational exuberance for their music.
Yeah, it was quite a ride. It was we were hitchhiking. We ended up, and we haven't talked about it yet, but we kind of did two loops. The first loop was a short loop that we took because I had to get back to my college for kind of an introductory to the campus. And so we took about a 2-week tour, and that's when we met these women. We were hitchhiking sort of back to our home early on in the summer, and they were so excited about The Dark Side of the Moon. And
it's a good album.
Yeah,
I'm not gonna lie.
It's a good album. But imagine the cassette tape players. If a lot of your listeners probably don't know what a cassette cassette tape is. But back then you had to fast forward and rewind and fast forward. And they had The Dark Side of the Moon on a cassette tape hooked up to the stereo system of the car. And they were just going track by track by track, fast forward, rewind, listen to this. This is amazing. Like, listen to that psychedelic music. Did you hear what that guy just said? He just said, I think I was drunk. And they were just going on and on about how excited they were about this music. And and Greg and I, my travel partner, we just kind of listened and were excited for them. And at the end of that kind of album of them going back forth, one of them turned to us and said, you know, so what do you think? And when we both said, you know, that was cool. But what we were really thinking at the time was, here are two beautiful women showing us their excitement for music, and all we could say was, yeah, that was cool. So yeah, in retrospect, you know, things don't always work out exactly as you planned.
Yeah, I'm always a much better conversationalist in my head.
Yes.
But you and Greg, so he has finished his freshman year in college when you start this trip. You have just graduated high school.
Yes.
How, I guess you're an adult, you're 18, but how did you convince your parents? You're like, I'm going to go hitchhike across the country. I'll be back before college.
Yeah, it's a common question. And so I will tell you like how it worked out. So Greg and I, in my junior year of high school, his senior year, we were sitting with a bunch of friends of ours around a lunch table in the cafeteria at our school. And we were talking about, what are you going to do this summer? I don't know. I'll be working. Greg was trying to figure out what he was going to do. So we were kind of talking about hitchhiking. It was a big deal then. And, you know, I turned to Greg and I said, I can't go on a hitchhiking trip this summer. But when I graduate next year, you know, I'd be happy to go on this trip with you. And so there in the cafeteria, at that time, 16 years old for me, 17 for him, we decided we would take this trip together. No contract, not even a handshake. We just decided, you know, let's do this. And for the year after that, so my senior year in high school now, we just periodically touch base. You know, we're still in. We're still going to do this, right? You know, you're going to gather up your stuff and all that. And you asked, how did I convince my parents? Frankly, I never did convince my parents.
You just went.
Just said, we're going. And neither of my parents, you know, objected. To me, at least, maybe they did in sort of private conversations with each other. You know, and I think some of it was, you know, my dad's story, you know, origin story was when he was in the Navy, and that was about the same age. And so I think he kind of respected the idea of trying to find yourself, you know, whether it was in the service or on a hitchhiking trip like this. My mother, when she was about the same age, she went and volunteered in the polio clinics in Texas. Mm. And her parents were very scared for her at that time. Not much was known about polio and how contagious it was and all. So, you know, in a nutshell, I didn't convince my parents. I just told them we were going, and they didn't try to say no.
I imagine that your commitment to go to college in the fall probably helped, right? He's not going forever. He's going, yes, for the summer.
Yeah. I'm sure that did help. I was not a fan of going to college. My mother kind of convinced me, go at least 1 year and, you know, you'll decide then. Don't decide now. You don't even know what it is. So yeah, I'm sure that it gave them some comfort that that there was a date I had to be back by. And in fact, that, you know, we talk about 50 years. When I published this book, June 4th for the paperback, was the day before. So 50 years in one day from when we left. And this week is actually the week we got back. So just as the students are coming back to OSU here, that's when we both needed to be back. And so, yeah, it was this week that we returned.
We also want to hear from you this hour. Have you ever hitchhiked? Would you ever hitchhike? Did you do it back then, but you'd never do it now? We'd love to hear your stories. You can call 614-292-8513, or you can email allsides@wosu.org. So you set off on this trip and you have $20. I know money went further back then, but why didn't you take more?
Yeah, so the whole purpose and the sort of subtitle of the book, Thumbs Up, Hitchhiking Across America, Fueled by the Kindness of Strangers, is the second part of that, Fueled by the Kindness of Strangers. And, unless you put yourself out there and make it impossible to not interact, to not depend on the kindness of strangers in this case, you may not. So the whole purpose was to leave, and that $20 that we had was a traveler's check.
Was it a collective 20?
No, just me.
Oh,
Greg didn't have anything. So I put a $20 traveler's check in the frame of my backpack, and I did that strategically because I had read in Abby Hoffman's Steal This book that the police could arrest you for vagrancy if you didn't have any money. And so we weren't going to have any money. We weren't going to use that $20, but I kept that $20 traveler's check in the frame of my backpack just in case. And the whole summer, I never took it out. And I used it the first time I went grocery shopping when I was in college.
Oh, wow. I want to talk about the kinds of people who picked you up, because it was actually all over the map. It was young women, it was old people, it was families.
Yes.
Was there any through line in who picked you up?
Yeah, there was a few through lines. And every time we would decide this demographic of people will not pick us up, the next ride we got would be that demographic. So I think it's a very broad demographic that picked up hitchhikers. But some of the common themes were, especially if we were picked up by older women, mothers, grandmothers, they would tell us the story about they have a son, daughter, niece, nephew that is out hitchhiking right now, and they just couldn't pass us knowing that there might be people passing their sons, daughters, nieces, nephews. So that was a common demographic. Another common demographic were, other hitchhikers that, have a solidarity around picking up hitchhikers. And then there were people that were just overall curious about what in the heck are you doing? These two young
the
kids
novelty of it.
With backpacks, in the middle of nowhere, and would pick us up and say, what are you doing? and some would be of like mind and say, wow, I wish I could do that. That's awesome. And others would not be so, happy about the idea of, being off and not working at that age and that sort of thing. So it was a very broad demographic.
I want to take a call from Paul in Columbus, who apparently hitchhiked home from a summer camp he hated. Welcome to All Sides, Paul.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, I was at Camp Wasiata, and I don't remember the town in Maine, but I didn't like it, and we had to do a lot of chores, even though some of us got paid for them. So I hitchhiked. Well, I left, and about a mile outside, I started hitchhiking. I wanted to go to the Greyhound bus station to go back to back home. And so I got a real nice ride with maybe everybody was older than me. I was 14, but he was a nice guy, and he actually took me to the bus station. And I got to the bus station and found out I really didn't have enough money for a bus. They probably wouldn't have sold me a ticket. So, but about 15 minutes after that, I noticed a Camp Wasiata truck was at the bus station. And so the guy, maybe he pulled over, used a payphone or something, but I had to go back to camp. Well, eventually I did go home because I was really homesick and I did not like that camp at all. But it was a very nice guy, and he really kind of took care of me by actually calling Camp Wasiata and telling them where I was, even though I didn't like it at the time.
Thanks, Paul.
That's a very common kind of story. One of the things that has been fascinating and exciting about publishing this book is it's brought memories back to people that either did similar things or at similar times. And as they tell me their stories, they're kind of reliving them themselves. And Paul, I don't know when the last time you thought about that. Maybe not for, since you were 14. But that's kind of the cool thing about this book. It's sparking memories in so many people and sharing them with me. It's very, very fun.
I'm going to take one more call from Dwight in West Columbus. Welcome to All Sides, Dwight.
Hi. Back when I just graduated from college, and this was from Ohio State in 1971, myself and a couple other guys took a sailing trip. And we sailed from Cleveland. The destination was Nova Scotia. And, we went up to Buffalo, and then we had to motor across Erie Canal and then down to Hudson, New York. When we got to Martha's Vineyard, we decided, let's go chance to see some of Boston and some of that. So we took the ferry over to Falmouth, and we hitchhiked, and the first ride we got was actually turned out to be a priest. And we wanted to go to Promise Town. We went there, and then some girls picked us up, and we got we dropped us off somewhere. And then some young hippies, they opened the car and got in a van, and we just hitched all over there until we finally headed back to Martha's Vineyard. And it was such a different time. I don't know if I would young person doing that today, but back then, and you get in the van, and they'd welcome you, and sometimes they would give you something that, I'll just leave it at that. And it made the trip a lot more enjoyable. Let's put it that way. But it was just a different time, and it was easy that you just put your thumb out and bam, you did they'd be picked up and friendly people. It was just a great experience.
Thanks, Dwight.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. That's exactly what I'm talking about. Stories like yours that are being sparked by this book as people read them. It's really exciting. I mean, every ride is a new experience and new opportunity to share with people, to learn what they're about, for them to learn what you're about. That's a great story. And it's, like I said, a common one that folks are sharing with me about, points in their past, whether it was, this is the first sailing trip. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
But also, bike trips and hiking, Appalachian Trail hiking, kind of all with a common theme of self-discovery.
We're going to take a short break. Coming up, why hitchhiking disappeared and perhaps what we've lost when it went away. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. 50 years ago, hitchhiking was part of the American transportation landscape. People sticking out their thumbs for rides across town or across the country. But today, the practice is all but extinct. Our guest today was among the last American hitchhikers taking his cross-country journey in 1974. Frank O'Brien Bernini is the author of Thumbs Up, a memoir about that summer and how it was, quote, fueled by the kindness of strangers. Frank, I want to return again to 1974 because it's also the year that the Texas Chainsaw Massacre comes out. And I bring this up because the horror film chronicles the gruesome adventure of five teenagers on a road trip. And the opening scene has them picking up a disturbing hitchhiker who attacks one of them with a straight razor. So first things first, have you seen Texas Chainsaw Massacre?
No, I haven't. I'm not a horror film enthusiast. So, I certainly know of it. I suppose everybody knows of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm not a fan of that genre.
Yeah. I wonder how you think maybe that scene and, movies generally have impacted people's feelings about hitchhiking.
Yeah, so I actually don't think it's the movies or art that has impacted the way people think. I I'm not a media specialist or anything like that. So my opinion is just my opinion, and I've got a point of view that the challenge associated with people fearing things like hitchhiking or maybe a lot of other activities that they may have to step out of their comfort zone is more about how we consume news. Mm. And the fact that, you know, when I was growing up, there was the sort of the evening news that was local news. And I don't know, maybe there was an event like you're talking about once every 5 years, so it would show up that way. Where now we're consuming national news, and across, you know, or around the world, there's an event like that happening every day, and so you hear about it every day. And I think you have we all have an outsized view of the dangers in the world.
Oh, humans are terrible at rational risk assessment. Like, yeah. I firmly believe that. But I will say there was also concentrated efforts by police, by FBI, to discourage hitchhiking. Mm-hmm. I found this campaign from the FBI in 1973 that asked you to consider whether the person you were picking up was a friendly traveler or a vicious murderer, or perhaps, it says, a sex-crazed maniac. And that kind of campaigning, that kind of it's too dangerous to risk it, I do think it plays a role. And by the time I'm born in 1983, we enter the era of stranger danger and America's Most Wanted. And the idea, I kind of wonder, do you think we've become less trusting of strangers as a culture?
Yeah, probably from the same reason that I just explained, that that it's not necessarily a rational fear, but it's one built from global awareness and translating that into sort of local risk. And so, it's interesting that you say that in 1973. I was not aware of that campaign. So the good news is the FBI campaign didn't hit the demographic of hitchhikers, apparently, since I certainly would have heard of that, or maybe my parents would have told me about it. So it probably wasn't a hugely successful one.
But it is, it's definitely changed. Also, cars last longer, they are less expensive. Airline travel has gotten a lot cheaper. Even weirdly, the number of female drivers on the road has mm-hmm. rapidly increased in the last 50 years. So there's been a lot of change.
Yeah, one of the things that is lost in that, so I totally agree. And a lot of folks that have talked to me about their trips did road trips in, you know, a lot of VW buses and that sort of thing. But, you know, something that is lost in that is individual travel, unless you very specifically and intentionally interact with the local people that you're in the areas you're driving through, and you purposely stop and go to, you know, a coffee shop or whatever, you actually don't get a flavor for the areas you're traveling through. So, that is one of the huge benefits to hitchhiking, is that you just randomly meet people generally that are from that area. They give you kind of short rides and hear what's important to them, what they're about. Then periodically you get a very long ride from, a long haul person that's like us, they're traveling across the country. And so you get a several hour ride. But I think, individual travel is awesome, but I think you have to be intentional about, having the opportunity to become aware of the culture of the areas you're passing through.
Yeah. Early on in your trip, you find yourself in Chicago, in a low-income part of Chicago, let's put it that way, and it has a real impact on you, and you meet this Black social worker. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, so we were walking through Grant Park in Chicago, and this was just a few days into our trip, and we were kind of walking through the park and lamenting to each other how, you know, we were getting very little eye contact. People were just sort of ignoring us. A lot of times when you're traveling with a backpack, there's a lot of curiosity. And so we were a little more expecting interactions and that sort of thing. So we sat down on a park bench and we were kind of talking about how cold the city felt. And this black guy came up to us and just started to talk with us and said, what are you kids up to? And, you know, we told him what we were doing and all that and how we kind of felt like the city felt cold as we were sitting here. And he began to tell us sort of his story. He was a social worker in Chicago, in the south side of Chicago. He had been a social worker for a number of years. And he talked about the difficulty of the folks living in, you know, what he referred to at the time, the ghettos, and how hard it was for them to escape the ghetto. Like, you know, we're kind of thinking, you know, 17 years old, we escaped our town. You just get up and leave, right? And he would explain to us that, yeah, it doesn't work that way, that, you know, a 17-year-old kid, if he got up and left, he'd be leaving behind his 6-year-old brother or sister who, you know, had to fend for themselves. So it was this cycle that he explained. And, you know, it was one of a number of times through the summer where someone would interact with us and kind of totally change the way we thought about something. And forever since then, 50 years later, I've had a different view of the socioeconomic challenges that that folks face and the responsibilities of folks that are more well off in the world to help out those in need.
I want to read this amazing email that just came in from Mike. This is fascinating. So he hitchhiked from Springfield, Illinois to Chicago many times in the 70s when he was going to and from college. That's mm-hmm. how he'd get there.
Yeah.
His mom would drive him to the interstate exit, drop him off with a suitcase and a poster that said student to Chicago. And that's how he'd get there. But here's the crazy twist. There was a guy who picked him up who asked him where he was going. And he said that his friend had a daughter who attended his same college. When he saw her at college, he mentioned that one thing led to another, and they've been married for 23 years and have 3 children.
Oh, that is awesome. Yeah, yeah. So if you're listening, Mike, congratulations. That is so cool. That is exactly what I'm talking about the connections that happen. And, you know, that connection changed your life.
Yeah, quite literally.
Yes, very, very cool.
I want to take a call from Dave in Cincy, who says he knows you.
I bet that's Dave Allery.
That is Dave Allery. How are you, Frank?
Hey, Dave, one of my high school buddies.
Yep, and that was our mode of transportation. We were kids from the time I was 13 to, well, 16 and beyond 18, if my car wasn't working or what have you. That's how we got around. And, you know, you're talking about good rides and bad rides. And I can remember even being 13, 15, 14, 15 years old. And we'd be in the car with the lady across the street. And she'd see young hitchhikers like us. And she'd stop way up ahead. And those kids would come running up. And they were almost to the door handle. And she'd take off and say, see, I got them closer than they were going, you know. But as you know, Frank, I did a lot of hitchhiking back and forth. To Xavier. I went to Xavier. Frank and I grew up in Springfield and went to the same high school and we're good friends. And then I came out to Xavier and then he later came out to Mid-Ohio for a job he didn't even know if he was going to keep and ended up being a senior executive vice president with Owens Corning Corporation. So we have stayed in touch through the years. But some of those rides were good and some of those rides were bad. I certainly took a friend home for Christmas one year. My parents would drop me off in August and pick me up in May. And my mom would say, if you want to come home for, you know, Thanksgiving, Christmas, Easter, thumb. So she was in favor of me thumbing. So one year we thumbed home for Thanksgiving, and I guess it was the early snow season, and we were on the way back, and another high school friend of Frank's and mine, Tony, dropped us off in Paterson, New Jersey, right at the beginning of the turnpike. But it was snowing, and he had to get back. Well, we got a ride, maybe an hour, and it was really coming down, and they ultimately closed the highway. So we found our way, walked to a gas station, and we ended up staying there for 2 days eating food out of a vending machine.
Oh, my goodness.
And this was a good ride, though, really. After we got out of there and they opened up the highway, we got picked up by a fellow from Kenyon College, which was still another 3 hours beyond us, but an hour and a half short of Xavier University. He felt so bad for us, he just drove us all the way to Victory Parkway at Xavier University. Wouldn't take any money, gas, anything from us, and then he had to drive another hour and a half back.
There's the kindness of strangers. There it is, Dave. You just captured it.
Yeah. But sometimes, and I do want to be clear, like, they weren't all great rides. And I know that Dave kind of referenced that a little bit. You have one ride with a bigoted driver who is fascinated with the movie The Exorcist. And I have to say personally that just sounds unsettling.
Yeah. So that was, we were in the Southwest and we were traveling. We had just come through Las Vegas. We were heading into New Mexico. And we got picked up by a guy that, he was, you know, definitely a bigot. And while we were driving, without really asking us, he took a detour off of the main route, which was, you know, kind of Route 66, Route 40 now. So he started going south and told us that he was going to take us to his farm. And
okay, you know, I know you don't read horror, but I want to stop you right there. That is the beginning of the horror movie.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, well, I'm glad I didn't see the end.
Thank you.
Because we got out of there before the ending. He was going to bring us to, you know, to feed us at his farmhouse. And along the way, he just started talking about, going from a just regular conversation to one sort of asking us if we hear voices. And, you know, he started talking to us about the voices that he hears. And
oh, no.
And kind of said that he had seen The Exorcist a couple weeks before, and he thinks that there's, you know, people talking to him, and so it was a little bit scary. So we got
you looking at Greg in the backseat, like,
yeah.
So we got to
his farm, and it was in the middle of nowhere. It was pitch dark, and we sort of nicely said, "Hey, we've got to get going. Thank you very much. This was great. We did eat with him, and then." We just walked off down his road, his driveway, in the middle of the night, pitch black. There were stars out, and we were very worried we were going to see his tail light or his headlights coming behind us, because we kind of didn't wait for him to say okay when we said we were leaving. We just said we've got to go, and so we ended up safely exiting that situation. However, that night we came across a kind of a pullover stop off of the road where there was picnic tables, and we're in New Mexico, rattlesnakes, tarantulas, scorpions. It was a little bit of a sleepless night there in that roadside pull off, but yeah, it was a harrowing trip, but here I stand 50 years later.
I bet you were glad to have Greg with you.
Yeah, it was helpful. There were two of us, sure.
You also eventually make your way to San Francisco in the Pacific Ocean, and you also end up having your first real experience around openly gay people.
Yeah, that's one of the experiences in the summer that I think most profoundly sort of shaped the way I thought and the way I've thought for the, you know, subsequent 50 years, is that, we grew up in a suburb of Springfield, Massachusetts, small town. There were no openly gay folks. It was, in the closet, if you will. And certainly there was gay folks in our town, but not that would talk openly about it. And so when we got to San Francisco, one of the first places we went is you have to go to Haight-Ashbury. So we went to Haight-Ashbury. And at that time, it was kind of after the hippie heyday of Haight-Ashbury. And Haight-Ashbury had kind of transformed into kind of a meeting spot where people would meet. And we went there hoping that we could find someone that would be willing to put us up, because it's kind of hard for a hitchhiker to find a place to sleep safely in a city. So that's what we were looking for. And we met this guy. He was a Berkeley professor, it turns out, who, you know, brought us out to dinner, brought us up to his really beautiful home overlooking the city. And he was openly gay, and he talked about that, and he talked about, you know, what are your feelings, all that. He was very, conscientious about, you know, he wasn't trying to do anything with
right.
us, to us, anything
he wasn't
like that.
On you.
Yeah, he was just having a conversation, and it is the first time, you know, in my life up to that point where I interacted with an openly gay person and realized that his hopes, dreams, fears, everything were exactly like ours. And it was, he was no different. And I think from sort of that point on, I had a different point of view, and certainly wouldn't tolerate, you know, gay slurs and things like that. And
that's the time of Harvey Milk, right? It's unfolding
exactly.
around the same
yes.
time.
Yes. So yeah, which is tragic murder, right?
Yeah. Our hitchhiking journey across America is going to continue in just a moment, only on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Saver. We're talking about hitchhiking across America this hour with Frank O'Brien Bernini. He's the author of a new book, Thumbs Up, Hitching Across America, Fueled by the Kindness of Strangers. And I have to ask, when your trip comes to an end, was it strange? Like, how did you adjust not only to returning to, quote, normal life, but to your freshman year in college?
Yeah, it was pretty surreal, actually. And if it's all right with you, could I read a section of the book from that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so I've got the book here.
Oh, you've got lots of tabs.
Yeah, I've got lots of tabs, but the tabs are for sort of different reasons for, but I think, you know, my return, so I'll read a little bit from returning. Because when we got to the end of the trip, we went to Cape Cod to visit some friends of ours that were kind of working on Cape Cod for the summer. And similarly, they were having their post-graduation summers and working in restaurants and bars and that sort of thing. So after I left the Cape, I hitchhiked home on the Massachusetts Turnpike. So I'll read that. I said, with a few succession rides, I completed the 145-mile trip from Hyannis to the bottom of my parents' street. Walking the last couple hundred yards up the hill to my parents' house was literally surreal. I felt a kind of re-entry anxiety of a stranger in a familiar land. Like I was having an out-of-body experience, I was observing myself walking up the street, carrying my backpack, and looking left and looking right and looking up and looking down at this familiar place where I grew up. And just like that, I was opening my parents' door, hugging my family. We'd walked off to look for America, and we'd found it. So that was this sort of surreal reentry of getting to my parents and really walking up a street that I grew up on. I'd lived there all my 17 years, and
Did you feel like a different person coming back?
It did, and it wasn't clear to me whether I had changed, my parents had changed, my siblings had changed. I think in 50 years of retrospect, clearly I was a different person. I was coming back with a lot of different perspectives, open mind in areas that, you know, I didn't even know I had a closed mind about prior. So, I did feel very much like, you know, the same at that time, Frank Bernini, but different for all the awesome experiences.
We've heard from a lot of men this hour, but we have gotten some emails from women. There's a Cynthia who was an Ohio University student who spent a semester abroad in Austria. And she said they hitched on Easter break to Greece and back. And they broke up because, you know, four people is too many to get a ride.
Yes.
So she says, we took off and fortune was with us. And outside of a strange detour in Yugoslavia, they made it back okay. And she is happy and healthy.
Wonderful.
So it's not just America. I mean, people have hitchhiked all over the globe.
Yeah, absolutely. And even the summer that we were out in 1974, I had friends that graduated with me that did hitch around Europe, or back then they had the Eurail passes, so
you backpack through Europe.
It was pretty inexpensive to even move around on the train system.
See, that's what I've backpacked through Europe and through Mexico. So that's my version.
Yes.
Now, it is, you're riding buses, it's much mm-hmm. less, but it is definitely a wild experience.
Yeah. And you have an opportunity when you're in public transportation to have those same kind of interactions. You're probably sitting next to someone who lives in the area and is going to tell you, you know, go here, don't go there. This is a great place to go swimming, all that stuff.
Yeah, you definitely get a lot of local flavor.
Yes.
Also, you discover things like the woman standing outside of the bathroom with the roll of toilet paper is selling it because there's none in the restroom, things you don't
yes.
realize. And you're like, oh,
but
that's
you only
what
do that once, right?
No, you only make that mistake once.
Yeah.
I want to take a call from Vicky in Columbus, who hitchhiked in 1969. Oh. Welcome to All Sides, Vicky.
Hi. In 1964, I entered Ohio State when they had quarter systems. And I went four quarters straight, and working part-time, going to school full-time. So by the end of spring quarter of 65, I was burned out and just thought, I have got to get out of here. So a couple of guys I knew were moving to Denver. They had just graduated and said they would give me a lift. Well, they got their VW bug packed and stopped by my house and said, sorry, there's just no room. So I went back in my apartment, made a sign that said Denver, dressed up as masculine as I could, and hit the road. And I made it to Denver in one piece, although there were a couple of very strange rides. And after one very strange ride, I had my thumb out and was watching cars go by with families begging them to stop, but of course they didn't. But anyway, I made it to Denver. And then the reason I was heading out that way, I had a brother in Denver who had done a lot of hitchhiking, but I'd heard about a hippie colony up in Ward, Colorado, which had been a ghost town after mining, and the hippies had taken it over. So I hitchhiked up there, and I didn't know anyone. Someone told me I could crash on their porch, and luckily I had taken a sleeping bag. So I helped people plant their gardens that summer. I was there only for a week, but I helped plant gardens and learn their stories. And then hitchhiked back to Denver. My brother didn't want me to hitchhike back to Columbus, so he bought me a plane ticket. But I did have some pretty weird rides. But all in all, it was a really good experience.
Oh, thanks so much, Vicky.
And here you are all these years later, and hopefully this conversation, you know, sparked that memory in a very fond way.
Do you have a favorite experience from the book?
Yeah, there are many, but one that I will say is that because it stuck with us from the day it happened to, you know, I've thought about it probably weekly since, you know, I'm a big music guy. I'm a drummer, so music is a big part of my life. We were on our way. We had left Las Vegas. We were on our way to Winslow, Arizona. And as we were standing there hitching a ride, it was hot desert day. It was maybe 100 degrees, and we were in the blazing sun
on the side of a road,
and we waited
hot.
For 12 hours
Ooh.
Waiting there for a ride, getting really quite depressed. And as we were standing there, all of a sudden, it was a girl, my lord, in a flatbed Ford slowing down to take a look at me. You know, and we're like, don't say maybe. Come on, baby. You know, stop and pick us up. And sure enough, the woman picked us up. She was going through Flagstaff on her way to Winslow. And so here we were getting our ride in, to Winslow, Arizona. And it was such a fine sight to see. And we were in the back of her. It wasn't a Ford flatbed. It was a Chevy pickup truck. But it was a woman that picked us up on our way to Winslow. And we just sat in the back of that pickup truck singing at the top of our lungs that Eagle song, Take It Easy. And so that was a hugely memorable ride.
How do you think, what is, I guess, looking back on it at 50 years, what do you think is the lesson? I don't know if there is a lesson, but what do you feel like you learned from that summer on the road?
Yeah, so many, many things. But I think the ultimate kind of thing, and I talk a little bit about it in the end of the book. I have sort of an appendix section that is designed to help people sort of discover how they became the person they are. And I think, one of the, my main takeaways is that it is the sort of the events in your life that are outside of your everyday living that, so not, sleeping, getting up, brushing teeth, outside of those experiences that stretch you and help you evolve to a better person. And, I think, you'll read it in the book. I do a bunch of what we call aside/reflection, which are standing back 50 years later and thinking about an event that occurred and sort of trying to pull that thread through to, I'll bet that's why I think this way about that. We had an awesome interaction with some migrant farm worker kids in Washington State who were working at a strawberry farm where we worked for a couple of days. And them, hearing that all we were eating was strawberries and them sharing their lunch with us. And I mean, it was a time of, you always hear, those with the least give the most. And here these kids, 8, 9, 10 years old, were teaching us adults what that meant and what kindness was. So, I think 50 years later, if I'm to give a recommendation, it's, find ways to experience things outside of your normal comfort zone. And it's likely it'll change your life for the better.
The final leg of your trip had a visit to Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Can you quickly tell us about the Yorty family? Because it felt like a really nice way to sort of end your trip.
Yeah. So the Yorty family, that was the only place on our trip that we visited twice. And we sort of met them on our way out. And then we came back to visit them on our way back. And they are one of those just amazing families. They had a small homestead that they were, grew their own food, and they had animals and all. So the way that we got to meet them is the mother and the grandmother picked us up, and they picked us up hitchhiking, which was a demographic that we did not expect. And the first question they asked us was, have you guys ever, tasted spring water? And we're like, no, we're from a city in Massachusetts. I don't even know what spring water is. This was way before you could buy bottled spring water. And so they said, would you like to come to our farm and we'll give you some spring water? And it turns out that they're the son of the mother, so the grandson of the grandmother, was currently hitchhiking around Peru. So he was in South America. So they picked us up with that, you know,
yeah.
They had to. And so they were an amazing family. And we had a great, great visit with them. And they are, you know, probably what comes to mind first when I say the second half of my subtitle of Kindness of Strangers. Just an amazing family.
Final question, possibly the most important one. Where do we find you? Where do we find your book?
Yeah, so the book is, as probably I think 90% or so of the books in the world are available on Amazon. So Thumbs Up, Hitchhiking Across America, Fueled by the Kindness of Strangers on Amazon. It's also in our local Reader's Garden bookstore in Granville, Ohio, and it's in the library there. And it can be in any bookstore. So if there are independent bookstore folks that are listening to this, I'd love to drop you off some books. So that's how it's available.
That was Frank O'Brien Bernini, author of the book Thumbs Up. Thank you so much for your time this hour.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure.